The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and all in 1 week. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
And it's good to be back with you, Barry. Great to be back on the air and talking about the things that are going on and see if we can't put a biblical worldview spin on them.
Well, you know, the first thing that we're going to be talking about today, actually, I don't think it's going to be too hard to do that, Charles, because what happened, you were recording this, surprisingly, Friday before it airs on Saturday, and yesterday afternoon on Thursday of this week, on May the 4th, which just so happens to be the National Day of Prayer Observance, Charles. And it was funny because I was seeing a number of folks that I know, good friends of ours, who went to the White House to be a part of the observance of the National Day of Prayer at the White House. Now, Chuck, when was the last time you remember there being an actual National Day of Prayer observance on the grounds of the White House?
2008.
Yeah, the last time George Bush was in office,
yep,
right?
Yep.
That was it. So it's been 8 years since there has been any observance or recognition, acknowledgement through having that activity right there at the White House. But they did. And, you know, President Trump not being one to miss a opportunity also took the opportunity of the National Day of Prayer to basically execute, or at least partially execute, let's just say partially execute, because it's not fully yet, partially execute his campaign promises on for the Christian community. And he promised a lot of things. But one of the things that he promised was that he was going to protect religious liberties. And so what he did yesterday, Chuck, he signed an executive order yesterday on religious liberty protection. And you know, and it's a situation where there's a lot of moving parts to it. But one of the big parts about it that basically, and this is what Trump said, and I quote, "No American should be forced to choose between the dictates of the federal government and the tenets of their faith." So that's he's basically saying that they're going to be very careful about anything that's coming out of the federal government, that it doesn't impinge upon religious freedom. Now, that can be a two-edged sword, because that also could mean stuff like a DOMA, you know, if gays and atheists want to say that they're quote-unquote religious freedom. I know atheists, that's a funny thing to say.
Yeah, well, but it is a form of religious freedom, yeah, to not believe, yeah.
Exactly. If they see the right to marry, you know, any gender or number that they choose to marry as part of their religion, then that could be a problem. But you know, really, what he's really trying to do is just kind of nail down some of these things that are kind of going full well overboard, such as the idea of, you know, the Justice Department and the Department of Education basically saying that you have to mainstream people who have gender identity disorders and force everybody else in a school to have to accommodate to them by letting a male dressed as a woman go into the girls' bathroom. So they're going to try to get away from those kind of things. And also, I think it's, you know, it may be, there may be more to it coming, because he's also signaled or has spoken out that one of the things that they want to do is to get Congress to repeal what's called the Johnson Amendment. Now, Chuck, I'm glad you're here with us, because you are our resident historian of all things on this program, because your grasp of history and the nuances of actions that have taken place in the past, I'm constantly amazed at. But you have got a good handle on, can let folks know what the Johnson Amendment is.
Well, 1954, if I'm not mistaken, right. Lyndon B. Johnson, who was a senator from Texas at the time, introduced legislation that amended the tax code. And what it amended the tax code to say was essentially that any church engaging in direct campaigning for specific or against specific candidates for elected office would lose their tax-exempt status or their 501c3 status. It was called the Johnson Amendment. And it came about because Lyndon Johnson, who was not a nice man and not particularly devoid of corruption, not particularly devoid of just a kind of a general arrogant and nasty attitude, got opposition from churches in his within Texas.
Yes.
And so he said, I'm going to put a stop to this because it's hard for a candidate to overcome the ministrations of a church that is active. In other words, a church who was basically saying, yes, Jesus Christ is not only the king of heaven, but he's also king here on earth. And therefore, I think it's Psalm 2 that says, kiss the Son, people who are members of churches who insist that the Son be kissed. Lyndon Johnson didn't like that. And so therefore he proposed this bill, and there were enough people in Congress who also wanted to stuff a gag in the mouth of churches, that it passed. It needs to be knocked out. It has needed to be knocked out now for 63 years, and it still needs to be knocked out. Can you believe it's been 63 years since this monstrosity passed? So, this is okay. I'm glad that Donald Trump is doing this, but no, it needs to come out of the tax code.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, and, you know, the White House has been fairly clear on this. What Donald Trump can do is basically, because the IRS sets under the Treasury Department, and the Treasury Department is a cabinet office which sets under the office of the executive, that he can use an executive order to basically tell them that they can't penalize or they have to treat fairly pastors and religious organizations who, if they choose to speak out. And this has been going on for a while, though. Chuck, you know, it's been kind of an ongoing thing that, you know, Family Research Council and some others have had what they call Pulpit Freedom Sundays. This started early on, I think, in the may have still started in the Bush administration, but I know it was during the Obama administration, where they would pick a Sunday and they would ask their network of pastors to preach a sermon on videotape around an election or around candidates and things. And you know, Jerry Falwell kind of started this whole thing, this whole idea, when he did it at his church at Liberty, where he would preach the sermon where he would endorse a candidate from the pulpit. He'd videotape it, and then he'd send it to the IRS and ask them to come in and you know, fine him or to investigate him. Well, Pulpit Freedom Sundays developed, and a number of churches, hundreds of them, started doing this and sending the videotapes to the IRS. And as far as I know from talking with many of the folks in and around that movement, the IRS never did anything because they knew better. They knew that if they actually did start investigating, it would unravel the whole thing.
Well, there was one church that I know of that has lost their tax-exempt status. For this particular thing, I think it was in the state of New York, and they lost it for one day.
Actually, yes, it was in upstate New York. It was called the Church at Pierce Creek. It was in 1992, and it was during the Bill Clinton run for the presidency, where they took out a full-page ad in the paper basically showing all of Bill Clinton's corruption and, you know, affairs and things of that nature, and basically said that he didn't meet the standard for a ruler under the scriptures, and so therefore Christians shouldn't vote for him. And yes, the IRS did investigate that, and yes, they did lose their ability to grant a they lost their ability to to give parishioners the credit for their contribution, their charitable contributions. And you're right, it was 24 hours. You know, they really were hammering them hard.
Yes.
And I think that it basically was effective for 24 hours, maybe on a Monday.
Yeah, it was a weird day of the week. It was like Monday or Tuesday.
It was a weird day of the week where they would not possibly have any kind of church services. There wouldn't be any Wednesday night Bible studies, Wednesday night prayer meetings, or Thursday Bible studies, or on Saturdays or Sundays. No, they hit it on like a Monday, I think.
Yeah, it's the day that the pastor normally takes as an off day. Yeah.
It's an off day, so there's actually no financial transactions that are supposed to be happening at the church. So, yeah, so the IRS did that. Kind of, you know, and I think part of the reason why they did that, they didn't figure that everybody would dig into and find out what the particulars were. All they'd dig into was this church got slapped for engaging in politics.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the fear factor. But again, it got out, and you know, and the story actually became a meme. And I think that part between Jerry Falwell, I think in the late 80s, early 90s, this case in 92, and then moving on up into you know, the rise of Barack Obama and the Democrat Party in power in Washington, you have these pulpit freedom things, which has now developed into an interesting mix, because during the campaign, candidate Donald Trump, his team really kind of, they knew what the ground was, because all of a sudden, I mean, he threw out this whole idea of he wanted to get rid of the Johnson Amendment, and it was almost like he lit a powder keg under the evangelical church. And you saw pastors jumping on board right and left. You know, Jerry Falwell's son, who now runs the whole Liberty, Thomas Road Baptist Church
and Liberty University.
And all the things that are surrounding that. Well, Jerry Jr. jumped right in there, and he, you know, he became one of Trump's biggest supporters. And you had a number of others, and you know, we chronicled some of that during the summer last year, spring and summer last year, as this was developing. But yeah, that was one of the key things that Trump was using in order to entice evangelicals to jump on the Trump train. Well, he's actually trying to bring it into the station, it looks like, because you know, he's really trying to get there. Now, again, some people are out there, you know, poo-pooing it, or basically, you know, saying, well, pah, you know, this isn't what he promised us, right. Blah, 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 blah. And it's like, okay, he's working to do these things don't get built up overnight. You and I both know that. The Johnson Amendment didn't just happen out of thin air in 1954. It happened because, you know, there was a whole history, and Lyndon Johnson was a shrewd politician, and he figured out how to effectively muzzle his opponents while making it look like he was giving them something.
Yes.
And so, you know, and that started the whole ball going. And then, of course, you know, the IRS, and we've had the thing with Lois Lerner, and they're, you know, looking askance at conservative / religious nonprofit filings for recognition under the 501c designation, C3, C4s. And all the congressional investigations. But, you know, this stuff has been going on, you know, that slow, subtle persecution or quieting, muzzling of the church. And it's going to take a little while to unpack because, you know, right, the point is that the Johnson Amendment was an amendment to a statute. The statute happened to be the Internal Revenue Act, which set up the IRS in the 50s. But it's going to take Congress to unpack and get rid of completely that provision of the code, or to modify that provision of the code. Now, I'm sure that many of these churches who are saying they want to get rid of the Johnson Amendment are saying, we don't want to be muzzled, and we want to be able to talk out politically when we need to. I don't think very many of them are saying, get rid of the 501c3 designation. Do you?
Well, look, as you know, the 501c3, that whole mess has been used. You know, the 501c3 has lent itself to the idea that people misunderstand why churches aren't taxed. liberals see it as that, well, churches aren't taxed because the government has just decided that they do something that's important enough that they shouldn't have to pay a tax. When the fact is that taxes aren't, churches are not tax exempt, they're tax immune. And why is that? Well, okay, we're going to go back to the real view of what the two kingdoms is about. The church is a member of a separate kingdom.
Absolutely.
The church is a member of the kingdom of heaven. That is why it's tax immune, not tax exempt. This isn't something new that I've cooked up. This is something that goes back to the Roman Empire. Latter days, when the empire converted en masse to Christianity. Now, does that mean when the empire converted en masse to Christianity, did everybody instantly become a born-again true believer? Well, no. And some of the emperors that were involved in converting the Roman Empire to Christianity were also not necessarily converted true believers. Let's face it, there you could argue plus or minus in things like Constantine, whether Constantine was truly a believer or not. Who knows? Says he was. And this is one of those places where judge not lest ye be judged actually has some validity. This is what it was about. We don't know what was in Constantine's heart. We don't know what's in the heart of anyone who professes Christianity. So therefore we got to take it on face value. There's another thing in the Bible that you got to pay attention to, and that is by their fruit you will know them. Okay, well, the C3 thing has lent itself to the idea that somehow churches are simply tax exempt and that it can be revoked at any time. There are a lot of churches that have never gotten a C3 designation. My church has never gotten a C3 designation. We're a nonprofit. We're a nonprofit corporation, essentially. So does that mean that my tithe is not deductible on my taxes? No, it is deductible on my taxes. You don't need a C3 designation. Camp American, which I am the executive director of, is a C3. Does that mean that we can't endorse candidates? Well, as it stands now, the answer is yes. But you know what? As the executive director of Camp American, I don't want to endorse candidates. That's not my purpose.
Right. That's not your organizational purpose.
My organizational purpose is to train people so that they can make an informed decision with the right tools in their toolbox to be able to choose the proper candidate. I will tell you right up front that as a teacher, I encourage people to ignore party labels and to quit getting caught in the trap of, well, he's a Republican or he's a Democrat, therefore he's going to do this, that, or another thing. That's not okay. Forget that. And in fact, forget the idea that someone who isn't running under the R or D banner isn't a decent candidate. Well, he can't win. He or she can't win because they're running, under the GLEP party. The reason they can't win is because
that's a bad party name.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a terrible party name. GLEP is a name that my go-to generic. Say the GLEP party. The reason he can't win is because everybody's sitting around going, he can't win.
Yeah, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, nobody's going to vote for that candidate because he's a GLEP party. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. That's a stupid reason. If you only want to support winners, you're going to keep getting the same thing over and over and over again. That's the kind of thing we teach. The idea that you'd simply vote for somebody because they can win, or you do the boogeyman thing. One of the things we have to do, Barry, as Christians, is learn how to think critically. And people, one of the things, the C3 keeps you from doing is teaching sort of a critical thought. If you vote for the GLEP party, then we're going to get Mrs. Foonman over here who's going to, do this, that, and another thing. okay, a negative reason to vote for a bad candidate is because he's not as bad as the other guy. That's the lesser of two evils argument. Mm-hmm. What's the Bible say about that? But the C3 lends itself to that kind of thinking. Well, this guy won't be as bad as that guy.
Right. Now, you know, and again, like I said, this is, I think, a step in the right direction.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are a number of things that are happening here. And basically what Trump's order said was he's directing his agency, i.e. the IRS, to give the maximum possible latitude when dealing with these particular issues.
Yeah.
Now, that really doesn't ban them from, you know, taking action against a nonprofit or trying to take away their nonprofit status, but the point is it probably will act that way, because even when they had the full support of, you know, of previous administrations to do what they needed to do, they refrained from doing so because they knew they were touching a third rail. But there, it's interesting because, like I said, Trump had promised this during the campaign, and of course, earlier on in the first 100 days of Donald Trump's administration, there was a draft of this religious liberty order that got floated out there. And that draft had a number of things in it which actually didn't show up in the actual order that he just did yesterday. And there are a couple of reasons for that. They're named Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump Kushner.
Yeah.
His daughter and his son-in-law, who are basically very much courting the LGBT movement and have really, they have been a roadblock to many of the things that Trump has actually wanted to do, but because they're becoming much closer advisors than anybody else, i.e. blood's thicker than water.
Yep.
He's listening to his daughter and his son-in-law pretty closely on a lot of these things. So really this EO, although many are lauding it, you know, with great fanfare, honestly doesn't go that far. It really, and the only other thing it does is to ease the enforcement of the contraception mandate under Obamacare, and we're going to talk about a little bit later where that's also being followed up, at least in some part, by congressional action. But, you know, when the Supreme Court ruled in the Hobby Lobby case, they basically said if you're a closely held corporation, i.e. like the family-owned corporation, and you have a religious belief that you shouldn't be providing or paying for contraceptives or abortion services in your health insurance, that you have the right not to. Well, Trump's executive order is now saying, well, you know what? We're going to make that available to more companies in America, not just the closely held ones, not just the ones that are held by immediate family members. And that's a good thing, because there are probably a number of companies who are founded on Judeo-Christian principles, but maybe partnerships, or maybe, you know, have you know, been bought by other companies, and there may be a conglomerate, but the conglomerate still has, you know, Judeo-Christian beliefs.
Yeah.
That weren't necessarily covered under the Supreme Court decision in the Hobby Lobby case. So that's a good thing. You know, and I'm going to give credit where credit's due. That's smart. You know, open that up and let these companies be able to make those decisions based upon what they believe is right for them and for their employees that they have under their hire. The big problems are really what it didn't include, which is I think a missed opportunity, unless they're going to try to come back and try to get these in some other way. One of the things, and there's a situation going on right now, that the original draft of this executive order would have done would have basically banned federal agencies from taking negative actions against federal employees or contractors because of their beliefs about marriage outside of their employment. Well, that disappeared in the executive order.
Yeah.
Problem is, there's a case right now up in Michigan, in Grand Rapids, a family called the Vanderboon family, who own a meatpacking company. And we were talking about this last week. Citizens for Community Values had their spring banquet and had reception, and they had a couple folks in from ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and they were talking about this particular case. This is a case where the company has a break room, okay, at their meatpacking plant, And the owner of the company, who is a staunch Christian, put some materials in the break room regarding the Christian view of marriage. Okay? Follow me here?
Yeah.
In the break room. Okay? They had an inspection by the United States Department of Agriculture, which is no surprise because they're a meatpacking plant and it's under USDA regulations.
Yeah, that's pretty regular. It's a regular thing, yes.
Yes, and you know by being, you get FDA inspections too, so you understand how this is all going on. But as the inspection was going on, the inspectors, there were two inspectors, from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they went through and they checked all the equipment and the sanitary conditions and, you know, their policies and things of that nature regarding safe food handling, all the stuff they were supposed to be checking on. They get to the break room, and they come looking around in there, and they see this material sitting on the table in the break room. One of the inspectors basically said, "You must remove this material right now. I'm offended by it." This inspector happened to be homosexual. "And if you don't remove this, we will fine you and we will deny your license to operate." And well, Chuck, right now the USDA is trying to enforce that. They're trying to enforce telling this business owner what he can and can't have in his business that doesn't have any direct relation to the operation of his business, which is what they're supposed to regulate. But they're telling him that you cannot put any materials in your break room that an inspector, a federal government official, finds offensive personally.
Yeah, that's a major, major, major problem.
Huge problem. And one that Trump's original draft of his religious freedom order would have addressed. Yet, when the order was rolled out, it didn't have it in there. Wonder why.
Yeah.
There was also another thing that there's a thing called the Russell Amendment. The Russell Amendment is an amendment they're trying to float in Congress, and Trump could have done it by executive order too, to basically say that anybody who is a contractor or a subcontractor under a federal grant, that if they are religious organizations, then they are not required to hire outside of their mission and identity. Because the Obama administration put a right rule in place that basically said that if you receive money from the federal government, if you're a federal contractor or subcontractor, you must align your hiring policies to include LGBT protections. Which is something that states like California and Oregon and others have done as well. But the point is, they're basically saying, if you're going to take federal money, then we are going to tell you how to run your business. Trump's original order would have adopted the Russell Amendment, which has been floating around Congress and hasn't landed yet, that basically would have protected those with religious identities from saying, no, 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 you know, we're a religious organization, or we are people of faith or a hobby or whatever it might be. And when we hire people, and we have a mission statement that may include a statement of faith, and that they have to follow that in order to gain employment with our company. Well, you know, if they happen to be a company that, you know, helps to pay their employees by getting federal contracts, they can't do that. They either have to lose the contract or they have to lose their identity and be opened up to accepting basically anybody, LGBT, atheist, whatever, you know, people who are diametrically opposed to the religious beliefs that they hold. You know, it's a recipe for trouble.
Yeah.
The original draft would have dealt with that issue. This EO, they were silent to it. Wonder why.
Well, okay. In other words, it's a bait and switch. Here's what you're going to get, and in the end, here's what you get.
Right. Well, and again, and many in the Pro family, and I know Tony Perkins and others had already decried that, because in February when that was floated out there, people thought that that was great. And then all of a sudden they were walking it back after Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner had a few private meetings with gay and lesbian folks, and then went in and talked to her dad, President Trump, and all of a sudden we're walking back most of this stuff. You know, that's a big problem, and it's a problem that's going to continue. And it's a problem that, you know, our friends in the evangelical and Catholic communities are going to just have to come to terms with. Blood is thicker than water. And a cradle Christian, as many like to call Trump during the campaign, because, you know, they believed he'd had a conversion experience. And I'm not saying he hasn't. But the point is that oftentimes, Chuck, your beliefs are not just influenced by what you feel, they're also influenced by who you associate with and what you absorb, what you read. You know, if you're reading the Bible on a regular basis, your beliefs are influenced by that. And if you're reading Karl Marx on a regular basis, your beliefs are going to be influenced by Karl Marx. If you are hanging out with, you know, on fire Christians who have a biblical worldview and are strong in their faith, you're going to be encouraged and be strengthened in your faith and sharpened by that. If you're hanging out with people who are LGBT friendly and are pro-aborts and believe that, you know, that all this religion stuff is for weak people, well, pretty soon you're probably either going to come to a major conflict in your faith, or you're just going to capitulate and go with the crowd. And that may be what's happening with this whole religious freedom order. Now, maybe there's more ways of getting at these things, especially the other part, which wasn't in there, which was basically a waiver and allowing companies to not have to provide abortion coverage in their healthcare plans. That's part of a religious belief system. That wasn't in there. Maybe they're going to try to get out that with the AHCA.
Oh, good. Oh, boy. Okay.
Because that was the other thing that happened the other day, was the House of Representatives voted and passed the AHCA, which is the replacement for the Affordable Care, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, with what they call the American Health Care Act, AHCA. In other words, the Republic version of Obamacare. And I am saying that it's just exactly the way it is. It's the Republican version of Obamacare. And it's very interesting, because what they did was they had all this thing, we're going to repeal and replace Obamacare. You know, we've talked about that. You've heard that, repeal and replace. Well, I'm not sure that they did so much repeal as they did just replenish Obamacare, because this AHCA vote, which made it out of the House, but I don't think it was, the vote was pretty tight on it.
They did it by three votes.
By three votes. That's exactly right. Added $8 billion in spending to cover people with pre-existing conditions. Now, okay, you and I both know that any insurance plan out there, if you jump from insurer to insurer and you have a pre-existing long-term healthcare condition, most insurers are not going to cover that, because that's basically changing the entire statistical dynamic of their risk pool.
Think about it this way. You go through your entire life, you never have health insurance.
Yeah.
When you were young, you didn't need it. And all of a sudden, when you're 40, you find out you got liver cancer. And you find out it's going to cost tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars for treatment. What you want to do is suddenly be able to go over and buy health insurance and say, see, you think you've bought into what amounts to a pool that you can jump in the deep end of and have coverage. People don't really understand how insurance works. The way all kinds of insurance works is it's a risk assessment. All your what you pay on a monthly or a yearly or a quarterly or whatever basis is based on your risk. That's why as you get older, it's harder to get life insurance, because let's face it, when you're 75 and you want to buy life insurance for the first time, are you in a high risk pool? Well, obviously. I mean, you're essentially at the expiration date. if you're talking averages, you're at the expiration date. So it's going to cost you more to buy health insurance or life insurance. If you're young, if you're 18 years old and you're looking to buy health insurance, it's going to be cheap because really, honestly, what risk do you have? A broken bone, maybe. Those are cheap. Something goofy like, cuts, bruises, abrasions. How about guys like me that are 60? What am I in the danger zone for? Heart attack, stroke, cancer, bone deterioration, disc deterioration, rotator cuff issues, all these kind of things that where the prices mount up, I'm high risk. What does that mean? Well, what that means is that I would have to pay more if I were going into the health insurance pool right this minute. People don't seem to grasp that. And in fact, what Obamacare was supposed to do was to force all these young people onto the system,
mm-hmm,
with the fines, and also to sort of cut the pain, it was to force employers to pay for it, or at least a huge hunk of it. Now, what did that do to the labor market, Barry? Let me ask you a question. Now, you're not somebody who necessarily employs anybody, but I am. What did it do to the labor market?
Oh, it shrunk it entirely.
Oh, of course it did, because all of a sudden, they not only changed the rules for when you had to provide these benefits, they changed the rules regarding how many hours it took to work to become a full-time employee. It used to be if you were 36 hours and above, you were considered a full-time employee. Now, they lowered it to 30 and above.
Okay.
So, in other words, all of a sudden, if you're working somebody 30 hours a week, and that's 6 hours a day, they were a full-time employee. Well, that's not full-time employment. But nonetheless, what did that do? Well, that forced a company to provide a health care plan or to pay a fine. Well, here's the issue. You either had to make the fine big enough and it all go back into the insurance pool, or people would just say, I'll pay the fine. I'm not buying insurance. I'm going to pay the fine. Okay, why should a 40-year-old man be required to pay for maternity insurance if he's not married and not, we're pretty sure he's not going to be having a baby? I mean, I would say the odds against him having a child would be astronomical.
Right. Now, it's very interesting because in the AHCA compromise, and this compromise supposedly was worked out between the House Freedom Caucus Chairman Mark Meadows and the Tuesday Group, which is the moderate leftist Republican group called the Tuesday Group, co-chair Tom MacArthur of New Jersey, to collect enough Republican votes to pass the bill. What'd we get from this compromise? Okay, one of the things that we got in this compromise was that they were going to allow states to eliminate the community rating system. And then basically what that did was, under this Obama situation, health insurers were prohibited from pricing health care plans based upon age, gender, or health status. Gee, Chuck, if you can't figure out, okay, it's going to cost me more for someone who's older or who has chronic health issues to cover them or to pay for their meds and things of that nature, if you can't take that into consideration, how do you set a rate? How do you effectively, as a business, set a rate in order to make sure that you're covering your risk and you're also possibly creating enough money to have a profit to pay your employees, et cetera? You can't.
You can't.
You can't. And so that's the reason why a lot of insurers had been getting out of these pools in many states. And I just heard the other day, in Iowa, there's only one insurer left, and they're on the edge of dropping out. You know, there may be states where there are no private health insurers willing to take that risk. And that was what Obamacare was all about, was to get us to a single-payer, government-run healthcare system. However, they're saying they're going to try to change this, but then there's it's one of those things that, on the other hand,
yes.
if you repeal – stay under this provision, if you repeal the community rating rule, you would have to join a high-risk rule pool to obtain a waiver. Okay, so there you got states in high-risk pools. Well, then we're going to make the argument, well, if we get to so many states that are in high-risk pools – we just need to, the federal government just needs to come in and provide health care. I can see that now.
Oh, sure. Look, this is all going to a single party pay system. It doesn't matter.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the bottom
line.
And it's
the moderate Republicans in Congress that are leading us there. This deal is known as the MacArthur Amendment because the Tuesday Group co-chairman is the one who brokered this deal. Now, basically, the states could weigh – there was the other thing. They reinstated something that we had gotten rid of already in Obamacare, and that was a thing called essential health benefits. Now, essential health benefits require health insurance plans to cover things such as doctor services. Okay, that makes sense. Inpatient or outpatient hospital care, that can make some sense. Prescription drugs, that makes some sense. Pregnancy, childbirth, and mental health. Okay. As you can guess, that would say that all of that is an essential service. And like you just said, if I'm a single 40-year-old guy, why am I paying for pregnancy, childbirth, and services? I don't have kids. I'm not married. I don't have a wife.
Yeah.
Why, if I buy a health plan, am I required to help pay for that?
Yeah, a 40-year-old man does not need obstetrics, gynecology coverage. Flat out.
Exactly. Now, the funny thing was, you know, a state could waive the essential health benefits if they could prove that eliminating those regulations would lower premiums, increase the number of people insured, or advance another benefit to the public interest in the state, unquote. In other words, there's really going to be no way to get out from under it. They can make those arguments all day long, but then it's up to the federal government to set the standard for what is and isn't a legitimate rationale. The other thing is it adds age-based tax credits to help people buy health insurance on the individual market. And Jim Jordan, the congressman from Ohio, who was the former chair of the Freedom Caucus, has railed against this and, as a matter of fact, voted against this bill in big part because of this issue, basically said this is going to create a new entitlement program.
Exactly.
And he's right. This is Social Security light. We're going to give you a subsidy based upon age, to go out and buy health insurance. For many people, that's a great soundbite. Because, yeah, we want grandma and grandpa to be able to have health insurance. Well, yeah, we do. But should the government be the one subsidizing it? Or should the family? Or should the, you know, if we gave some more flexibility and latitude and stopped having all these, mandates upon what the health insurers can and can't do, could grandma and grandpa start affording health insurance? The answer is likely yes.
Well, look, the bottom line on this whole mess,
yeah,
is that this is going to cause healthcare costs to skyrocket. And the reason going to do that is because what's happening is that insurance companies are now going to be directly subsidized. And what will that do? Well, okay. For-profit corporations that run hospitals, and basically most doctors are being forced to come under the umbrella of these. Doctors can't operate independently almost anymore because of the costs of billing and maintaining the records and that kind of thing. So what that will do, these hospitals, do you think there's any incentive for them at all to maintain a cost umbrella, to maintain a cost ceiling? I don't see any. I can see corporations looking up and saying there is no roof on this thing. Let's get as much as we can. The only way to stop it is the way Britain has stopped it, and that is by going to a single party payer where essentially every little tiny bit of your healthcare treatment has to go through a bureaucracy. In other words, a bureaucrat has to rubber stamp your treatment. And if that means you've got some kind of an aggressive cancer, like an ovarian cancer or something, and it takes 3 months to get the approval for the treatment that you need, you die. you die. Especially...
That's exactly right.
And especially, this is why you hear nightmare stories about people in Canada who can't get surgery for hip replacements and that kind of thing for 6 months, a year, 18 months, that kind of thing, because they have to go through all the paperwork. So people are sitting around talking about pre-existing conditions, how it needs to be covered and all that. Yeah, there needs to be something for those people, but why they're included in the insurance pool, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense at all, except that corporations are railing for it. And Rand Paul just wrote, has been very vocal about this particular part of this thing. He said the AHCA is the newly passed thing is the first time the GOP has supported deplorable practice of subsidizing insurance companies.
Right, exactly. Which, if you think about it, Chuck, this is no different than the bailout. This is no different than, basically everything that Obama did with the auto industry. This is subsidizing health care, and which basically means you're taking it to a fascist health care system.
Yes.
So that you can get it to a communistic health care system where the government is the single payer.
Yeah, for all you people who think fascism and communism are all that far apart, no. The bottom line is, when we say fascism, we don't necessarily mean brown shirts and black shirts going around beating up
people.
No. We're subtracting out the nationalistic element and talking about the economic system. Economically, fascism is, it's going to be very simple so you can understand it. Instead of, in communism, the state owns all means of production, all businesses, all the machinery, all the whole apparatus of government. Under fascism, a private ownership is allowed, but the government supplies the capital and the labor, and if there are cost overruns, supplies the cost overrun. And the return for the company, for the private ownership, is that they have to do whatever the government has them do. In other words, yes, you still own your company, and yes, you still have freedom to move within the rules that we have set up for you. That's the difference between fascism and communism as an economic system.
Right. Now, the other thing that's in this particular AHCA bill is something that when they floated it the first time, everybody said, no, this is bad. And that is that they're replacing the individual mandate, and that's the fine that you get if you don't show the government at the end of the year on your taxes that you had health coverage during the year, with a 30% insurance premium surcharge. So if you don't have health insurance for a certain time period and then you get it, your insurer is going to be required to charge you a 30% premium surcharge. So if your premium's $500, it's going to cost you $650. And who gets that money, Chuck? Is it the insurer or the government?
It sure sounds like the insurer gets it.
It's the insurer who's going to get it. Of course. That's part of the subsidy.
Oh, believe me, they're going to find all kinds of ways to manipulate that to make sure they get their extra 30%.
Right. Now, on the upside, and people would hoot about this, that it's capping the Medicaid per capita spending, but that doesn't start until 2020. So even if the bill passes, Medicaid's still going to grow, and the spending's still going to grow at the federal level till 2020. And then it caps it at a certain rate. And that may or may not be a good thing, but let's not kid ourselves. That's not going to be a part of what comes out of the final version of this bill, because already the U.S. Senate has said this bill is not going to come through here the way it came out of the House. In other words, they said we're not going to accept the House version.
Right.
They've already said it.
It's
the thing
be, yeah.
Past Wednesday, Thursday morning, they're saying, forget it, it's dead over here. And part of the reasons why is you've got people like Rob Portman, our senator from Ohio, basically all upset about this capping of Medicaid. Gee, I wonder who Rob is working with when he basically he's going to try to be a blocker on a freeze on Medicaid expansion.
Well, of course, he's working with guys like John Kasich.
John Kasich, you got it, my friend, who has been traveling more to D.C. than he has been to his office in Columbus. begging and pleading with them not to cap or not to eliminate Medicaid expansion. Why? Johnny's built his entire budget around it. That's the reason why. And it's very interesting because, you know, we've got this whole situation where the Senate's not going to take this, but I think it's hilarious because I'm looking at an article in Breitbart News, House Passes Revised American Healthcare Act. Sean Moran wrote this article. You remember how I said that the chair of the Freedom Caucus, Mark Meadows, was the one who brokered the deal with Tom MacArthur from the Tuesday Group in order to get the Republican votes, i.e. the moderates, to vote for the bill to get it passed? I really think because Breitbart asked Meadows for a quote, and when I read the quote, I had to laugh. I just had to laugh, Chuck. He says, quote, or he says he told Breitbart News that he will work with Senate colleagues to push for a more conservative version. Quote, I'm having conversations with my colleagues in the Senate where we can push for even more conservative solutions because it was more difficult to push amendments procedurally in the House. Unquote. Okay, let's just be quite honest here. If Mark Meadows didn't have the moxie to get conservative amendments in the bill in the House to the point where he had to come and broker a deal with one of the co-chairs of the liberal Republican caucus in order to basically give them enough to get them on board to vote for the bill and give up things like, you know, the tax credits and the essential health benefits coming back and those type of things. How in the world does Mark Meadows think that he's going to be able in a Mitch McConnell-run U.S. Senate that's barely sitting on enough votes to pass this thing in the first place? And I know who he says he's going to work with. He's going to work, you know, it's Rand Paul, who you just mentioned, Mike Lee from Utah, and Ted Cruz. And they're all coming out saying that they want to see some significant changes in this, and they've already had their own plan. You know, Ron Paul has his own bill. But if Mark Meadows and it couldn't corral people or become or obstruct enough to get them to force them to get it done the right way, what makes him think he's going to be able to go across the street to the Senate or across the other side of the Capitol building to the Senate and get them to, you know, get all those moderates in the McConnell caucus to go along with something like Rand Paul's bill?
Yeah,
I'm not seeing it.
Oh no, this thing will get eviscerated in a conference.
Oh, absolutely.
Any conservative pieces that end up in it will be ripped out because you and I both know that there will be not enough Freedom Caucus types in a conference to make to make it get through.
Yeah, but you know what? I'll have to say one thing though, because I'm guessing that this package was too conservative for some members, because you had a number of Republicans who voted against AHCA. Jim Jordan voted against it, but you know, somebody like, and I saw this list, they showed 20 Republicans who crossed over and voted no. I'm not sure if Jim Jordan voted against it or not. I'm going to have to look that up. But they had a list of 20 Republican members who voted against the AHCA bill, and two of them were from Ohio. And I thought it was hilarious because you would have thought you would have seen like Jim Jordan or Brad Whistler or somebody like that. No, who'd you see? Pat Tiberi and Dave Joyce.
Uh-huh.
Two of the least conservative members of the Republican congressional delegation from Ohio.
Yes.
Now, I think it's hilarious because, you know, they can make all kinds of arguments. And I saw Dave Joyce trying to defend his vote. But really what they're basically saying is it really wasn't close enough to Obamacare for us to support it.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what it was.
So, now the sad part is, and maybe it's not so sad, but you know, it's when you've dealt around this stuff as long as I have, you see it because the White House was basically celebrating the passage in the House, and I'm thinking to myself, you guys are popping the corks on the champagne way too early.
Way early.
Way too early. Because by the time this all gets done, even your strong people in the House for the administration are probably going to be capitulating. And I'm honestly guessing that the latter end will be worse than the former, Chuck. As you know, as similar to what Scripture says about, you know, the man who had the demons cast out and then they came back in sevenfold, so his latter end was worse than his former. I think that's what's going to happen with the federal health care.
Oh, you're going to take an abysmally bad situation, and I think the Republicans have found a way to make it worse. The only fix for this system is to completely rid ourselves both of, and I realize this is going to get people, my mom depends on this, or my grandmother depends on this. The only way to fix the system is to get rid of Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare. Look, if you
You know what? I need to walk back a comment, and I apologize. First of all, I need to walk back two comments, so please forgive me. This is what happens when you're doing this stuff on the fly sometimes.
Yes, it does happen.
Jim Jordan did not vote against the health care bill. Okay, he voted in favor of it. He opposed provisions of it, but he voted in favor of it, hoping to see if they can't work something out in conference.
Yeah.
The two members in Ohio, one was Dave Joyce, and I saw those comments, but the other one, I'm sorry, it wasn't Pat Tiberi, it was Mike Turner from Dayton, who also is not one of the more conservative members of the House Republican Caucus from Ohio. But there's a list, there were 20 that voted against it, and one or two of them, I get it because it was on principle. Walter Jones from North Carolina, Thomas Massie from Kentucky. They've been huge opponents of government being involved in healthcare at all as libertarians.
Yeah.
But there, some of the other ones, you know, Chris Smith from New Jersey, Ileana Roslitinen, or whatever, however you pronounce her name, from Florida, Frank Lobiondo from New Jersey. You know, I'm going down this list and I'm thinking these are not your rank and file, you know, Freedom Caucus guys.
No, not hardly.
Especially with Dave Joyce and Mike Turner. So I want to apologize because it wasn't Pat Tiberi, although saying he was one of the least conservative members is still accurate.
Yeah, I was going to say that's not an inaccurate statement.
But he voted in favor of it. But Turner and Joyce voted against it. And I'm seeing, you know, well, we feel we get more of this and we didn't go as far as we needed to here. And it's like, well, no, you just basically are upset because you don't want to change anything. That's really what it gets down to. Now, they may get their wish because by the time it gets done in the Senate, my guess is there really won't be much change in Obamacare except maybe the locus of control. Again, instead of paying a fine to the federal government, you're paying a premium surcharge to the insurance companies. And instead of, you know, having a direct subsidy, you get a tax credit, but that creates another, you know, entitlement class. I honestly just am shaking my head because Republican leadership, and I use that in air quotes, leadership in the House and the Senate and Congress have proven that they don't know what to do with the ability they've been given now that the Republicans now have control of both chambers of Congress and control of the White House. You know, this gets right down to, it was proven by the vote on the continuing resolution for the budget funding in order to avoid a quote unquote government shutdown when they handed over and basically just adopted the Obama based budgeting from 2016 and added money for things that the Democrats wanted. As a matter of fact, when Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are both coming out beaming that they're excited about the budget continuing resolution, you know you've capitulated completely and given them the control. That's what our Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell have done. And so there's the ugly of this whole thing. The good, some religious liberties protections, hopefully will go more. The bad, AHCA really kind of leading still down the road to a single-payer system with all these tweaks and letting the moderates set the pace. And the ugly, handing it completely over to Pelosi, Schumer, and company and basically continuing to fund Planned Parenthood. Now, supposedly they defund Planned Parenthood and AHCA. I'm waiting to see that. But they did certainly continue funding for it in the continuing budget resolution, which stretches all the way into September.
Yep.
Funny enough, just enough time so that it stretches all the way into the development of a new budget for the upcoming federal fiscal year.
Well, okay, that's it. The good, the bad, and the ugly. You know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.